Welcome to Line by Line Bible Studies. My name is Paul Stringini. We are studying in the book of Isaiah. This is chapter 29, verse 1. Woe to Ariel, the city where David dwelt. Add ye year to year, let them kill sacrifices. Yet I will distress Ariel, and there shall be heaviness and sorrow, and it shall be to me as Ariel. I've gotten mixed messages over time about what Ariel means. It's used in 2 Samuel chapter 20, verse 23. Or is it 23, verse 20? One of those. Of the men slain by Benaniah, one of the mighty men of David. They are called lion-like men. In Hebrew, that is literally men of Ariel. Then you have stuff like in Ezekiel chapter 23, where it's Harel, which means the mount of God or the hearth of God, the altar hearth. In that case, it is a related word. But I think that's significant because of the content here. It talks them adding year to year, let them kill sacrifices. It refers to the cycles of the feasts. Because remember, in ancient Israel, it was not lawful for the people to make sacrifices for themselves. They weren't to set up altars all over the place. And the point was, lest you start sacrificing to the sun and the moon and the stars. They were to make their sacrifices at the place which God had designated, which was at first the tabernacle, but eventually it came to be the temple at Jerusalem through the Levitical priesthood. And so when it talks about making sacrifices, the people would come up to make sacrifices at the appointed time. And so, you know, that's what it's referring to. Let them add year to year. Let them have sacrifices. But even so, I'm going to distress them. Because, you know, there's in some sense which God is not pleased with all this. You know, they go through the motions of religiosity. They go through the motions of service to God. And this came to be in the days of Christ, too. That's why he cast out the money changers in the temple, because his whole sacrificial system had become a farce. You know, as he repeats it, and I wonder about that, if he wasn't making a play on the dual meaning of the word or the different ways this word could be taken. Because to the Hebrew ear, it's going to sound like a couple things. You might hear lion of God. You might hear altar of God or hearth of God. You might hear mountain of God because it's similar. So you hear these things, and he could be playing on the different meanings of the word. Or of words that sound similar. A little wordplay. There will be heaviness and sorrow, and it shall be to me as Ariel. Meaning, is it going to be to me as a lion? I don't think so. I think he means it's going to be to me a place of burning, a hearth, where the sacrifices are burnt. They go up and they make sacrifices, but I'm seeing Jerusalem as a place of sacrifice in a little different way. I'm seeing Jerusalem as a place of sacrifice where God's people are going to be cleansed, just as the sacrifices of the altar are cleansed. And this is how, verse 3, and I will camp against thee round about, and I will lay siege against thee with a mount, and I will raise forts against thee. Speaking to what? Jerusalem, the city where David dwelt. That's what we're talking about. The Lord would send his chosen vessels to destroy Jerusalem. First, it was the Assyrian. I believe it was Sennacherib. And he certainly distressed the city, but he did not take it. And that was because God had mercy on Hezekiah, as we will read. But then Nebuchadnezzar, who did destroy the city at a different time, that's yet future. But ultimately, he sends his Antichrist also to lay siege against the holy city. What does it say of him? He is that man of sin, that son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, so that he, as God, sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And that does not mean showing himself reflexively, like, hey, I'm looking at me and I think I'm God. What it is he's making a show of being God. So then he speaks of the degradation that shall be brought about against Jerusalem, against the city of God. by the impact of the enemy coming. You will be brought low, brought down. Notice how it's repeated here. Out of the ground, out of the dust, out of the ground, out of the dust. They're going to whisper like one that has a familiar spirit.
Because people who have familiar spirits whisper. Because they like to seem all dramatic in that.
But this will be truly dramatic, truly traumatic. Because all their pride and their loftiness is being brought down. It is being made low. And they will whisper out of the dust. That should draw your mind also to like Genesis chapter 3, where it talks about, on your belly shall you go, and dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. And that certainly makes one think of a snake, but it also speaks to the sense of utter degradation. Eating dust, you know, is how much closer, how much lower can you be than one who eats dust? One whose face is in the ground. Verse 5. Moreover, the multitude of thy strangers shall be like small dust, and the multitude of the terrible ones shall be as chaff that passeth away. Yea, it shall be in an instant suddenly. You know, all the enemies which come against Israel that they fear, themselves are like chaff. You know, chaff is the like, you know, you have weed or grass clippings or whatever. I'm not going to get into how that's all made. You know, there's a threshing process they go through in ancient times to separate grain from the chaff. And that's the husks and all the small bits of vegetable matter that are dried out. You know, think of it as the ultimate kindling. It's the stuff that goes up so easily. If you get the air thick and full of that, it's just about explosive, I believe. I mean, it burns. You're saying this stuff goes away in like dust. It just blows away. It doesn't take a whole lot to blow the dust away. And so ultimately, this is going to come about very quickly. You know, you see that in the end times. The kingdom of Antichrist is at the end, it is turned over to the kingdom of Christ in just a very brief amount of time. And so it was with the Assyrian that, you know, one day he was there, the next day he was gone. All that he had set, you know, in siege against them to destroy them. I mean, and he did a lot of destruction. He may have been turned away from Jerusalem, but he went up against all the cities of Judah and took them, you know. And many of the people were sent into captivity, not just of the northern tribes of Israel, but also of Judah. We'll read about it. It's coming up. So, you know, the Assyrian had a major impact on the national character in that sense, that he was, his invasion was devastating. But ultimately, it only went so far. You know, it only went so far. God would not suffer the nation to be utterly destroyed. And so also, you know, in the end times for us, that God, you know, will allow us to be harmed, and we may suffer many things, but we will not be utterly destroyed. Verse 6, thou shalt be visited of the Lord of hosts with thunder and with earthquake, and great noise, with storm and tempest, and the flame of devouring fire. It reminds me of things you read about in Revelation. There are voices and thunderings and earthquakes. And great hail. And here we have a similar idea. The storm and tempest. The earthquake. The great noise. The thunder. And the flame of fire. Ultimately, there is a fire that comes out of the mouth of the Lord. Isaiah alludes to it earlier. Remember, he had said, Tophet is ordained of old, for the king it is prepared. The pile thereof is fire and much wood. The breath of the Lord of hosts, like a stream of brimstone, doth kindle it. Wait a second, that's actually coming up, and that's the next chapter. Yeah, it's 30, not previously. I thought I was thinking 3, but it's not 3, it's 30. But we'll get to that. The last verse of chapter 30, you can preview it. The breath of the Lord of hosts is the fire that consumes. God is a consuming fire.
Is not my word like as a fire, and like a hammer that breaketh the rock in pieces, saith the Lord? Jeremiah chapter 23. I think that's the quote I have up on my website under Oracles of God. The flame of devouring fire. Verse 7, and the multitude of all the nations that fight against Ariel, even all that fight against her and her munition, and that distress her, shall be as a dream of a night vision. It shall even be as when a hungry man dreameth, and behold, he eateth, but he awaketh, and his soul is empty. Or as when a thirsty man dreameth, and behold, he drinketh, but he awaketh, and behold, he is faint, and his soul hath appetite. So shall the multitude of all the nations be that fight against Mount Zion, like a dream. They're going to pass away. And they're like, you're dreaming and you're just eating, but you wake up and you're like, huh, I guess I wasn't eating anything. There was nothing there. That's what the enemies of God are like. It's like when it's over, it's like they were never even there. They will be like a dream. They're going to pass away. A very simple analogy. All that fight against Mount Zion, and as Christians, all that fight against us, all that fight against the gospel, all the people, all the heathen that rage, all their words that are spoken. That's why you can afford to be gracious. You can afford to be kind. You know, a lot of times I feel like Christians behave as though they don't know they're the conquerors. They don't have that confidence that comes with the knowledge that you have won. You know, the idea that we've won is not something that I think has really penetrated our minds sufficiently. And that our enemies are like a dream. They're going away. It's going to be as if they never existed. Poof, you wake up and they're gone. That goes for all the enemies of God. And whether it be false teachers, false prophets. You know, so recently someone asked me about some guy I'd never heard of. And this guy thinks he sure is something. And, you know, me knowing about somebody or not knowing about somebody is no measure of it. I listen to this guy, I'm like, boy, he is not ashamed to proclaim himself. I don't know about the gospel. I never heard mention of the gospel. All I heard was how great this guy is. You know, how, boy, he sure is something. He really thinks he's the new Elijah or the Spirit. He has the spirit of Elijah, and he's here to perform Elijah's duties for this time. How wonderful. And I listen, and what's he got to add? You know, people are eating it up. But someday they're going to wake up. And they're going to find out that they're still hungry. And that they haven't been filled. They're still thirsty. They haven't been drinking. I remember that was the meaning that when I was younger, I really latched onto that sort of religious significance. Like when Jesus talks about feed my sheep, you know, and that if someone believes in me, he will have a well of water in him welling up to everlasting life. If you come to me, I'll give you this living water and you'll never thirst again. But it seemed to me that so many of the mainstream preachers that I was observing and stuff, that what they were offering people was like dream water. It's not truly filling them up. I don't know how I feel about that specifically anymore, because I don't really listen to what's going on out in the, you know, Christian broadcast world. Because to me, that's such a small segment of what Christianity is all about. What's being broadcast. And the TV shows. And I'm glad that the internet is sort of killing all that. I really can't wait for the day when that television ministry thing is just absolutely, a thing of the past as far as its predominance.
we live in an exciting time where it's like, you know, anyone can really get up there and speak and have a platform. And that's a good thing. It's beautiful. Even if it's all in disagreement and there may be a sense of that this is like chaos. But the point is, in that, we can thrive. We can get the true gospel out. Whereas in the old days, you had to have a big ministry to be able to do something like that. And now dedicated believers can do that. And many do. You know, for good or evil. Whether it be dream food or real food. Whether it be the living water or just something that's going to evaporate out of your stomach as soon as you wake up. Verse 9. Stay yourselves in wonder. Cry ye out and cry. They are drunken, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. Saying, like, look, hold on. You know, get a hold of yourselves here. I want you to wonder at this. It's time to hold on and be amazed at something. We've got people who are drunk, but not with wine. And they're staggering, but not with strong drink. And I don't think this is going to apply to any kind of drug either, because that's not the point. You know, it's not that they got heroin or mescaline or LSD or methamphetamines. That's not why they're staggering around. That's not why they're drunken. Verse 10, for the Lord hath poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep. And hath closed your eyes, the prophets and your rulers, the seers hath he covered. And the vision of all is become unto you as the words of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one that is learned, saying, read this, I pray thee. And he saith, I cannot, for it is sealed. And the book is delivered to him that is not learned, saying, read this, please. And he saith, I am not learned. I used to take this way too literally. Like, that's how people actually were. They're like, oh, you can't understand the Bible. No, that's not true. Everyone thinks they understand the Bible. There's all kinds of interpretations. And especially in the regards to the gospel, the New Testament, there's a lot of interpretation and prophecy and all this stuff. A lot of people don't really cover the Old Testament prophets, not in detail. So I felt obliged to do it, because when I was young, I was interested. And the only one I could find who was teaching that was Arnold Murray, a terrible teacher. But he gave me something to bump up against, some idea against which I could start framing reality. I could take the ideas he's giving me and compare that with the scripture. At least I had some framework within which to work. You know, because I didn't get caught up in the cult of personality around him. I just saw him as doing what he purports to do, which is offer up the Bible. Though, it becomes apparent once you start studying, more closely that, you know, what a lot of these people do is not just throw the Bible out there. They're throwing out the Bible plus their assumptions, plus their traditions, plus their fantasies, plus a lot of things that you don't necessarily know coming out the gate what it is that they've inserted in there with it, where the poison pill is. But what Isaiah is saying is this drunkenness that he's observing. You remember in the last chapter we talked about the drunkenness among the priests, that they were staggering around in their vomit like sloppy drunks. Well, here it is explained that the Lord has poured out the spirit of deep sleep and has closed your eyes. Jesus talked about, he that hath ears to hear, let him hear. And when he asked Peter, he said, who do men say that I am? And Peter said, well, some say Elijah, some say one of the prophets or some other prophet. He says, okay, Peter, but who do you say that I am? And he said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said, blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this unto you, but my Father which is in heaven. God is the one who opens our eyes. And if our eyes are not open by inference. He is the one who has closed them. And that is not only inferred, that is specific to this passage in the prophet. Now, people who don't believe in this sort of thing always find lots of ways to conveniently explain it away. And, you know, I understand there are a lot of things in the Bible that beg explanation because there are things that seem to say things that are at odds with each other. Like when you talk about second death versus eternal torment. Those ideas are at odds with each other, yet the same passage contains both ideas. So how do we weigh which one is in need of interpreting, which one is supposed to be a little more metaphorical and which one is supposed to be a little more literal? But I think the idea of God opening our eyes is so, you know, central to the New Testament narrative and to understanding why people don't receive the gospel that I have no other way of looking at this than this is true. That God does pour out upon people a spirit which causes them to be asleep. That word sleep is not really a great word. Deep sleep. In my first album, I actually called it stupefaction, which was a sloppy reading of the English, because the word is stupefaction. It means to be put in a stupor. It's not like sleep, really, except the drowsiness that comes on you when you are exceedingly drunken. Like when you're ready to pass out, when you're insensible. You know what I'm saying? When you're so drunk, you become insensible. You know, like you don't have your senses about you. You're not reacting to things the way a normal person does. You're slow. You're sluggish. You're barely hanging on to reality. And he's saying he's poured upon you this spirit of deep sleep, of stupefaction. And has closed your eyes. The prophets and the rulers, the seers, have he covered. He starts at the top. He starts with the religious leaders, the political leaders, you know, the spiritual leaders, I don't know, the seers, you know, your visionaries, the people who should be seeing clearly, their eyes are closed. The people who should be speaking, the prophets. Prophets is one who speaks for God in the Old Testament sense of the word. One who's a spokesman for God. The spokesman, in fact, I see in this the sort of the see no evil, hear no evil, and speak no evil. The prophet is the speaker. The ruler is the hearer. He's supposed to hear God's commands. He's supposed to hear the will of the people, or the needs of the people, in any case, and to rule wisely. The prophet speaks, the ruler listens. The seer sees. They've all been blinded. They've lost their senses. And so, therefore, the vision of all, or the whole vision, the complete vision, is become to you as the words of a book that is sealed. Because these people have become, you know, insensate. They're not able to perceive the vision. What vision? The vision of God. The thing that we must see. The truth that we must see is obscured from our eyes because God has poured out on us this spirit. Well, us, me too. Well, I don't know. You know, I'll tell you what. I've spent a lot of my life trying to come to grips with the scriptures and trying to wake myself out of sleep. The New Testament contains the same idea of like, now is high time to arise out of slumber and to wake up. For they that be drunken in the night. And they that sleep, sleep in the night. So let us be awake and watchful. And you got to wake up a bit. It's not enough to just be passive and not observe. You know, it's not enough to, you know, if we aren't attentive to this salvation, if we neglect so great a salvation, what is going to be left for us? If we don't want to be asleep, then we got to fight to be awake. So Paul, well, I thought you said God does it. Yeah, he does it. He does it. Because you, no matter how much you try to open your eyes, you don't even understand what you're opening them for or towards. The thing that needs to be seen. I mean, think about in this world, all the things there are to see and perceive as salvation. You look at riches and you think, there's my salvation. I can have a wonderful car and a house and, you know, I can live in a beautiful part of the country and I can be wealthy and have servants and all these things, you know. And you think, okay, the cares of this life, the deceitfulness of riches, that's what the vision is all about. That's what I'm supposed to be seeing. That's what I'm supposed to be setting my eyes upon. Or maybe you have more modest notions. Doesn't have to be that extreme. And it's like, I'll just use my life for example. I just want to own my modest home. I want to pay off my mortgage. I want to live happily with my wife and children until they grow up and then live happily with my wife. And see my children and my children's children do well. You know, I just have my eyes on all these earthly things that I want to go well. And that's not an evil desire, but that is not the vision we need to have. That's not the whole vision. The thing we're supposed to be seeing is Jesus and his gospel. And the power of God unto salvation. I need a vision of that. I need a vision of what it is that has to happen in my life to bring me to the resurrection. That is the vision I need to be seeing clearly. That is the vision that can't be like a sealed book to me. The analogy he uses, the details are not so important. I used to really put an emphasis on, they go to someone that learned, that's a priest, they go to, but, you know, you go to the person that's learned, what it's saying is, you can't read it. It's like you bring it to somebody and they can't tell you what it is. You go to somebody else and they don't have any idea of what it is. I mean, I understand life. There are people who say it's a mystery. And there are other people who say, well, I don't know. And there's a lot of people who like to say, well, nobody knows. Nobody can know, because I don't know, and it offends me that other people think they do. I see that a lot from people. People get offended if you think you know the way. If you think what the whole vision is all about. If you think you know what the whole vision is, there are people who are going to hate you for that. So they despise the gospel and the preaching of it. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's due to the fact of it being misunderstood. Like today, I saw someone in a discussion, they were defining religion as belief that some part of you persists after death. Like that you continue in your existence, like that your consciousness goes on after you die. And I'm like, well, what, you know, and obviously I thought this person has never heard of the idea of soul sleep, as they call it, or as I believe, just death. They don't know that a lot of Christians do believe you die and you are dead. And then that the only way out of that is through resurrection. And so we're not talking about being a disembodied consciousness. Because as I said, the idea of a disembodied consciousness, that just pure consciousness could just waft around the universe, they're like saying that's impossible. For one, they don't know that's impossible because they don't even know what consciousness is. So you can't say what's impossible to be consciousness since you don't even know what it is, right? But even so, that's not even the belief of, certainly of me. And I would say certainly not of the Bible, but of a lot of people. Yes, I know some people believe when you die, you just step from one plane of existence to another. And God bless them. I hope they come to a better understanding. But my point was that they were trying to say that's basically what religion is. Belief in this afterlife type thing. I'm like, that's weird. Then I guess I'm not in a religion. But of course I am. It's a bad definition. Forgot how I got to that from this. Well, basically it was the idea that, you know, all kinds of people have a lot of ignorant opinions about what the vision is about. what the whole vision of God is, what the big picture is. You know, they don't see the big picture. They don't think you really can see the big picture. Some because of ignorance, others because they just think it's, you know, they're smart and they've learned and they think that that's just out of reach. You'll never know. And claiming to know is an offense because they claim to know that you can't know. Verse 13. Wherefore the Lord said, for as much as this people draw near me with their mouth and with their lips do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder. For the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent shall be hid. So he's saying, in the, they don't see the big picture. I poured out on them the spirit of stupefaction, like they're in a trance, right? And the big picture has become unknowable to them. And he's saying, but they draw near me with their mouth. They talk about being near God. And they honor him with their lips. Praise the Lord. You know? I love Jesus. You know, when I see someone talk about God or praise the Lord, I can't judge that whether or not that's outwardly only or whether they really believe it. I mean, unless they're being intentionally sarcastic or something. Praise the Lord, you know, and making fun of it or something, being mockers. I mean, generally speaking, if someone acts sincere, I can't really do anything but assume they are sincere. But the Lord sees something else. See, he knows. The Lord looks in the heart. He knows what's in our heart. Therefore, when he sees us praising him and our heart is removed far from him, he knows this for a fact. That's why there is coming a great apostasy when people are going to turn their backs on Jesus. Wholesale. Not just the way they are, but I mean, you're going to see all the fake Christians just disappear. They're just going to turn their backs on Christ because there's going to be a new game in town that will be so persuasive that the whole world is going to go after it. It's going to be the new world religion, and it's going to, and they're going to be shoving it in our face. This is the new God, and he can do miracles, and what has your God done lately? You know, they're going to shove it in your face. And for a lot of people, for people who have drawn near God with their hearts and with their lips, I mean, not with their hearts, but with their lips only, they're going to be carried away in that. Because they don't fear God out of the way man ought to fear God. Which is not by precept, but by nature, by understand, by be, you know, getting to know who, what, and how God is. You know, to know God is to fear him. The more you know about him, the greater your fear should be. And I don't mean a fear in the sense of, you know, people always think of fear like, oh, he's going to destroy me. He's not going to save me. I'm going to burn in hell. It's not that kind of fear. And I've described this many times, but I'm going to use it again because it always works for me. It's like when you are on a high place and you look down and you see it in terms of how you could fall and that fear. And one time I had, a downed electrical wire. And I saw the power surging as the neutral and the, you know, positive wire, you know, the hot wire, when they touch it, it creates this surge of electrical power and it burns itself. And it was, it was making this, because it was a real high voltage wire, like a feed wire coming into a building. And it was, you know, very scary because of the raw power there. And the reason you feel fear is you understand the nature of what you're looking at. And you understand the nature. And I'm not saying these things can't be taught. You can teach this fear of God in a sense, but it's something that has to be felt. It has to be understood. When you understand God, you will fear Him like that. It has nothing to do with any sense that He would be, you know, like this idea that He's malevolent or something like that. That's not how we fear God. We don't fear Him like, oh, He's a bad guy. We fear Him the way a child fears their father, understanding how strong and powerful He is and how absolute my authority is over their lives while they're young. To have your fear taught by the precept of men, you know, fear becomes not fear. Their fear becomes not the fear of God and what He is. But it becomes like, well, we got to do the rules that the guy said we have to do. And if we don't follow the rules, then we should be afraid. If we don't follow the A, B, C, D, E, F, G of what we're supposed to do, then we have fear. See, they're honoring God with their lips. They have this knowledge of this, what God wants from people, you know. And it could be right or wrong. It doesn't really matter. But it's not heartfelt. You know, they learned it by rote. By repetition. Just, it's the facts and nothing but the facts. And they can spit back their, you know, however they've been catechized into whatever kind of religion it is. Verse 14. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to... Oh, I already read this, but... What does he say? Because of this, the wisdom of their wise shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid. Such a devastating thought. That God would take the wisdom of the wise and kill it. And the understanding of the men who should be of understanding, the prudent men, and hide it. This is something that people don't like to think of God doing, of pouring out sleep on people, hiding wisdom. The Apostle Paul makes reference to this in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, or is it 2? Right there in 1 or 2, or 2 or 3. Basically that the wisdom, you know, we've received this wisdom of God in a mystery which none of the princes of this world, for had they known it, they would not have crucified the Lord. If they had known, you know, that they were crucifying Jesus, the Son of the living God, they never would have crucified Him. They would not have willingly done that. Not necessarily because they love Him, but because they love themselves. If they truly knew what they were doing, and they truly understood, in a very immediate sense, the consequences. Now, people say that, you know, penalties for various crimes don't really act as a deterrent. That's because the wisdom has been hid from those people. They don't have the mechanisms in their minds to really see the consequences of their actions as a real thing. I'm not just making this up. I've, you know, done a little bit of studying on criminal behavior, because what, you know, the things that cause men to sin are a special interest to me. You know, because we have these, you know, criminals, a lot of times their impulse control is bad and they don't really think in terms of the consequences. They're dead to it. The consequences are not as bright in their vision as the immediate gratification of what they're about to do. They're thinking more of the $50 they can get from the guy than about the consequences that might follow if they pull the trigger and kill him. That's what makes these people dangerous. But what happens when the wise among us are, you know, the wisdom, the true wisdom, the things they should be privy to? You know, the vision, the big picture, it's hid. What then? When all the wise men you turn to are fools. You know, when all the wisdom they give you is nonsense. When the answers they think they have are, you know, dream water and dream dinner. As soon as you wake up, it's all going to be gone. Verse 15. Woe unto them that seek deep to hide their counsel from the Lord, and their works are in the dark. And they say, who seeth us? And who knoweth us? Oh, nobody knows what we're doing. We're totally hid. This is a bit of a, I don't know what kind of figure of speech you'd call this, because they don't really think, oh, we're trying to hide our counsel from God. They don't believe God is there. They hide their counsel from men, thinking that no one sees them, forgetting that God sees all, or being ignorant of it, not having the wisdom to see it. Nobody knows we're doing this. We're totally getting away with this. Are we not clever? How many people in politics are doing that? You know, behind closed doors, they're doing things that they don't want to be seen in the light. They don't want everyone else to see what they're up to. And they think, but no one sees it. And nothing can happen. But God sees. Verse 16. Surely your turning of things upside down shall be esteemed as the potter's clay. For shall the work say of him that made it, he made me not? Or shall the thing framed say of him that framed it, he had no understanding? Now this reminds me of Romans 9. You know, where he says, you know, you will say to me then, why does he yet find fault? Paul, it says here God has poured out upon them the spirit of deep sleep. And he closed their eyes. And it says here he hid the wisdom from them. Or he hid the understanding, whatever. Same thing, you know. Caused their wisdom to perish and hid their understanding. It says all that, well, why does he yet find fault? And what does Paul say in Romans 9? Nay, but whom, O man, who art thou that repliest against God? And that's not a cop-out. The idea is, shall the work save him that made it? He made me not. And that's what it's getting at here in verse 16. This is what Paul is quoting from. Shall the work save him that made it? He made me not. Why does God find fault? Because you are faulty. You were made to be faulty. You're a faulty creature that God was gracious enough to bring into existence. And make an offer. That those of us that could hear his voice can live forever. But we must hear his voice and believe in him. And by that, he will lead us and bring us to the place of eternal life. He calls to us, and we hear his voice. Hath not the potter power over the clay? God has this power to make of one lump a vessel of honor and also a vessel of dishonor. Like Jacob and Esau, they were of the same lump, same father, same mother. The same material, same basic genetic pattern, though they were different, no doubt, as brothers often are. But still, they came out of the same place, one unto honor, one unto dishonor. Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. And if you don't like what you've been made, perhaps you would rather that God had made something else. Instead of you, he could have made some other person who was more worthy of existence than you are. So that's the point. You question your own existence when you question the Creator. And his simple response is, I've made you. Well, why'd you make me this way? Why didn't you? If I made something else, then I wouldn't have made you. And your questioning becomes ridiculous. Because if I didn't make you, you wouldn't be here to ask the question. And, what you know, and well, Paul, why does God make faulty creatures? Why did he make us? It's like because he wanted to have mercy on us. There we were. We didn't exist. Human beings. And God wanted human beings to exist. He decided to create us in his image. In the process of time, he would offer to us salvation if we would hear his voice. And he gave some of us that ability to hear. It's because he's good and merciful to those who do not deserve it. That's why God made faulty people, because he is good to people who do not deserve it. He is good to creatures that do not deserve to exist. That is why God made faulty. He could make perfect people. Maybe you'd rather he made perfect people instead of you. You know, he had no understanding. He didn't know what he was doing. Look at me, I'm full of flaws. God didn't know what he was doing. He knew what he was doing. They turn everything upside down. They think God doesn't see. But they are the ones that do not see. That was the point about turning it upside down. I almost passed it up. They think God doesn't see. But God has already said, no, you don't see. You're blind to the totality of reality, what God is doing in this world. Verse 17. Is it not yet a very little while, and Lebanon shall be turned into a fruitful field, and the fruitful field shall be esteemed as a forest? And in that day shall the deaf hear the words of the book, and the eyes of the blind shall see out of obscurity and out of darkness. The meek also shall increase their joy in the Lord, and the poor among men shall rejoice in the Holy One of Israel. So here we have, he's saying, you're turning things upside down. But then, ironically, he says, yet is it not a little while, and Lebanon shall be turned into a fruitful field, and the fruitful field shall be esteemed as a forest. You've been turning things upside down. I'm going to turn things upside down. Is it not a little while, and I will turn the world upside down? I'm going to change the world. That which is high is going to be made low, and that which is low is going to be made high. That which was a fruitful field is going to become a forest, and the forest is going to become a fruitful field. And the world will change. He's going to turn things around. He's going to change things. And the order that is now established is going to be overturned, and something new is going to be put in its place. And to me, this is a reference to something millennial, to the kingdom of Christ. And I see that just in this passage. When I was a student of Arnold Murray, I mean, this was a big thing for me, because this passage, you know, talks about the deaf hearing the words of the book and the eyes of the blind seeing out of obscurity. And I thought, yeah, you know, they're all going to learn in the millennium, because I thought that basically that everyone was going to be raised at the beginning of the millennium. But that doesn't make sense, because the book of Revelation says that the rest of the dead live not again till the 1,000 years are finished. This is the first resurrection. And you can spiritualize that away if you want, but I can't. It bugged me for so long. It's part of what turned me away from that ministry. It refers, though, to people who are blind, but they will survive the end times. They won't be God's elect on that. They're not going to be part of the first resurrection, but they will be left on the earth, and they will be brought into God's kingdom to populate that kingdom. And yeah, they're going to hear the words of the book, and their eyes are going to be open, and they're going to see. You know, the meek shall inherit the earth. The meek shall increase their joy in the Lord. The poor among men shall rejoice in the Holy One of Israel. You know, everything that was low is going to be exalted. The meek, you know, those with control. Because very often people without control will ascend to the top. You know, you look in the chaos of the Bronze Age and stuff, and well, this is actually Iron Age, I believe, by the time we're talking about Isaiah. You know, the kingdoms of the Iron Age, that was a bit of a chaotic, kind of dark age there. after the I think the late Bronze Age, there was a Bronze Age sort of civilization where, you know, all the kingdoms of the world were kind of connected. This is in the time of Abraham, you know, and there was a falling apart of that world order. And that's the chaos out of which Israel became a nation, or in which. And, you know, and then emerging into the Iron Age and such, and the Assyrian Empire and the Babylonian Empire. And this is a sort of a dark ages. A lot of people don't understand this, but there was a dark age there where the communications between these ancient civilizations were broken down, where, you know, there was a lot of world trade and stuff like that. It was gone. And in that context, you know, in those chaotic times, a lot of times, yeah, might makes right, so to speak, meaning, you know, they're the only ones left standing to say what's right. They're the only ones with the power and the will to rule. And so the people who are of self-control and who don't try to lord it over people, they get run down in these times. But not in God's kingdom. God's kingdom is going to be a place where the meek have a place, where the lowly are exalted, and where the poor are going to rejoice. Verse 20, for the terrible one is brought to naught, and the scorner is consumed, and all that watch for iniquity are cut off. They make a man an offender for a word, and lay a snare for him that reproveth in the gate, and turn aside the just for a thing of naught. Well, that makes me think of our times. You know, with those who make a man an offender for a word. You know, those who make a man to be an offender for a word. There are certain words they don't want you to use anymore. Why? Because they're offensive. But then it gets to be so touchy. You know, where does it end? Well, you're not allowed to say, you know, racial slurs. I kind of get that. I don't like to insult people. You know, I can buy into that. It doesn't mean I think there should be a law against it, but I guess a general societal taboo. But then they want to start putting these speech codes on and changing the language. You got to use these weird gender pronouns. At least in Canada, it's law. And there are people who would love to make it law here because they don't love free speech. They want to control your speech because they want to control you and lord it over you. They want to make you an offender for saying the wrong thing. That's a totalitarian state. That's why it talks about the terrible one brought to naught, the scorn. You know, these evil rulers that exist within the chaos when civilizations break down. And the scornful men, you know, who scorn traditions, the traditions of the Lord. I mean, the Moses, the way things were, and Christianity and our civilization, they hate these things. They're scornful towards them. They watch for iniquity because they love that. Like, let me see what the latest iniquity is I can see. Let me look out my window, and can I see a robbery? Can I see sodomy? Can I see some sort of evil deed being done? What wickedness can I look into now? Because that's what I watch for. I watch for iniquity. They shall be cut off. They make a man an offender for a word, and lay a snare for him that reproveth in the gate. Yeah, someone in the gate, which is the place where people come in and out of the city, it's the natural place where people would speak. If you wanted to get the attention of a lot of people, you would go to the gate and start saying, the way things are going are wrong, and the ways that this nation has turned are wrong. You know, repent from your evil ways and follow the Lord. You know, do the law of Moses, perform the works which he has commanded. You know, they would say those things, and then the rulers would begin to get upset because they would be critical of how the leaders were leading them astray and going contrary to God's will. See, free speech is important even in the Bible. This is where we get the idea. There's a reason why a nation that is so notable as a Christian nation, that was founded by people who were, by Christians, who were trying to escape persecution in the old world from the established religions, they came here. And so the men who founded this nation had a love for the freedom of thought and expression which made different religions able to exist peaceably together if we would all agree to tolerate one another and to understand that each man is entitled to follow the dictates of his own conscience. And that it's not the business of the state to tell any man what he ought to think or to regulate the content of his speech. And that if he thinks something's wrong with society, he has a right to say so, not only to the people, but to the government itself. He has the right to speak the truth to the powerful. But in our world today, the people are, they don't understand the value of these things anymore. They've turned aside from the truth and the wisdom that our fathers trusted in the scriptures and in the Bible and in Christianity and the teachings of Jesus. And they are following after God knows what. You know, whatever, basically the precepts of men. They've set up new gods which they fear according to the new rules. I fear lest I should give any man offense. It's the greatest fear of all. Lest I should make someone uncomfortable. Lest I should make someone feel inadequate. Lest I should make someone feel like they aren't part of something. You know, we don't want to show families with a strong father and an obedient wife and, you know, happy children. No, we don't want to show that because then families of, you know, well, there's two lesbians, they'd feel left out. We don't want people to feel left out, so we'll just show everything but the most healthy and righteous thing and the most common thing until recently, until they started trying to tear it all down. Verse 22. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, who redeemed Abraham, concerning the house of Jacob. Jacob shall not now be ashamed, neither shall his face now wax pale. You know, when you lose all the blood in your face, trauma, you know, shock. But when he seeth his children, the work of mine hands in the midst of him, they shall sanctify my name, and sanctify the Holy One of Jacob, and shall fear the God of Israel. They also that erred in spirit shall come to understanding, and they that murmured shall learn doctrine. That was a passage I viewed as very millennial. I still do. Because I do believe that there is somewhat, you know, I've erred in spirit. I need to come to greater understanding. I know that my understanding is not perfect. Because I can't summon into my mind this perfect understanding that I would like to have. There are holes in my understanding. I know it's not understanding perfectly. And this lack of understanding leads me to error. I would like to think I'd never murmur against God. I don't really murmur against the Lord. But in a sense, when we sort of lose trust in him, or start even believing, you know, like, well, I don't think I'm going to make it or something like that. You may think it's about you're murmuring about you, but you're not. You're murmuring against the Lord because he is the one who has promised to save you. He hasn't said, hey, I'm God. Believe in me and save yourself. You know, that's not what he does. Say, put your faith in me and then get your bootstraps and pull yourself up and get out of the muck. Save yourself. He does not do that. He does not ask us to save ourselves, but has promised to save us. Therefore, we should believe in that and trust it and live our lives as though that is exactly what is happening. And not merely as though, but because we believe it. Live our lives believing that is exactly what is happening. And then this God is speaking of Abraham, who he redeemed, concerning the house of Jacob, that Jacob would not be ashamed or wax, you know. Jacob was the heir of God's promise. We are the heirs of God's promise through Christ. We are the Israel of God. We have been grafted into the tree with them, one body in Christ. When Jacob sees his children, the work of my hands, in the midst of him, meaning in one body, which is Israel, you know, Jacob is often, you know, he is a man, but the nation is often referred to as Jacob because they are his seed. They're going to sanctify his name. They're going to sanctify the Holy One and fear him. Not according to the precept of men, but according to truth. So we have a coming to understanding and a learning of doctrine. I need to know God's doctrine. I need to know the truth. And I do believe that when the Lord comes, you know, that which is not yet perfect will be made perfect. But until that time, I want to labor and struggle to find my way to be as close to perfection as God has given me the strength and time to pursue. You know, I'm on this earth for a while. It's kind of like when in the book of Hebrews it says, you know, by reason of time you ought to be teachers. But you have need again that someone teach you which be the first principles of the oracles of God. You know what I'm saying? Like, I've got all this time. He's saying, you've got all this time. And so what are you doing with that time? You know, in the amount of time you've believed, you maybe could have become a teacher. It's not saying you have to be a teacher. No. But after a certain amount of time, the time it would take for you to become a teacher, you certainly shouldn't need someone to teach you. It's all right to listen to someone preach. And, you know, and the thing is, a lot of times we may be a Christian for a long time, but we don't have the resources or anyone to teach us so that we could become a teacher. Or maybe we don't have gifts. But the point is, even if you don't have the gift to become a teacher, you have the gift to become something. We can all become more loving. We can all become more gracious. We can all become more holy. We can all become more sober. Now, not just in the sense of literal sobriety, like from alcohol, but actual soberness of mind. You know, not full of ridiculousness and stupidity. You know, there's more levels to all these things. We can become more temperate. We can become more perfect in all the aspects which we ought to have in order to be like Christ. And that's what I seek to do while I have time and breath. And so as time goes by, we want to see progress towards that goal. You know, and you don't know how much time you have or how much the grace of God is going to require of you. But be assured of this, that the Lord is your Savior. He's not asking you to save yourself. Therefore, you know, your salvation is entirely dependent on Him. So that's something you can trust in. And so you can move forward believing that you're going to have everything you desire in this. You will. So anyways, this has been Line by Line Bible Studies. My name is Paul Springini. You can listen to all my studies on oraclesofgod.org, oraclesofgod.org, oraclesofgod.org. Thank you for studying with me. I look forward to studying with you again very soon.